the Nobel Committee, which nominates honorees for the Peace Prize, made no selection this last year. It was that kind of year. True, the major powers of the world seem to have concluded that the balance of terror is such that little is to be gained from eyeball to eyeball belligerency. There were even a number of accommodations between the major powers when it was to their mutual advantage. President Nixon jetted across the bamboo curtain. The foolish quarantine by which the United States had tried to deny the existence of one quarter of the world's population, was lifted. Ping pong teams traveled hither and yon. Acupuncture became something of a medical fad. People's Republic of China was admitted to the United Nations and Taiwan was expelled. There were the first minor trade agreements with mainland China, the beginning of a policy by the West which admitted the existence of this major power. President Nixon's visit to Moscow during the year set in motion the Soviet purchase of American wheat to make up for their own short crop, established a number of binational committees dealing with the health and environment, agreed to a joint planning for a space program during 1975, probably most important of all, agreed to a treaty which would limit the spread of nuclear-headed missiles at the present level of dispersion. When President Nixon arrived in Moscow, he said, that one can come to Moscow only in peace. His thoughts were obviously on Napoleon and on Hitler. And of course, what he said was true. He cast himself in the role of a peacemaker, a general of peace. We wish that this were true. But there were indications throughout the years that there was a degree of restraint being exerted by the major powers. When the United States' response to a major North Vietnamese invasion of Quang Tri province and of the highland area of South Vietnam was the return of bombing north of the demilitarized zone and the mining of Haiphong Harbor in May, the response of the People's Republic of China and of the Soviet Union was remarkably low-keyed, as it was again these last weeks, when after the disruption of the most recent round of negotiations, the United States again began to bomb seriously in the Hanoi and Haiphong areas. And there was a clear understanding evolved during this past year that in the Middle East, the powers would pursue their separate and independent positions and support their own favorite allies and the smaller countries allied with them. They would avoid being entangled in any kind of military activity by Egypt or by Israel, and the Soviet Union was willing even to pay the price of this temporary cooling in Egyptian-Soviet relationships because of her unwillingness to grant technical aggressive arms to the Egyptian government. Now, the involvement of the world in these kinds of arrangements was all obviously a plus to the good. But the lions had not suddenly become lambs. during 1972, more arms were sent to the undernourished parts of the world, the third world, than in any year in the 20th century. England, France, Germany, the United States, the Soviet Union, the Soviet satellite countries, the People's Republic of China were busy sending military credits and military equipment to the Middle East, to Black Africa, to Latin and South America, to the Indian subcontinent, and into Indochina. A new policy seemed to have been evolved in order that the great powers might pursue their traditional imperial ambitions. Since they couldn't gain what they wanted to gain face to face by facing one another down, they operated at the once removed or at the twice removed through allies and through satellites and through governments that they tried to sponsor and through revolutions that they tried to undertake. It was all very much reminiscent, I'm afraid, of the condition of the world before the First World War, when the balance in power in Europe was also a fairly balanced one, and where the governments of Europe pursued their colonial ambitions in Africa and in Asia, and suddenly little places like Algeciras and Agadir became flashpoints where Germany and England or France and England faced one another down over imperial ambitions. And as in that pre-World War I period, so now, there were all kinds of agreements and treaties, known and secret. The world was becoming a world of terrific political complication. And as the smaller, more irresponsible nations, each of which, of course, has its own set of political, greedy ambitions, just as the great powers do, began to pursue these, the dangers in our world remained very high. The flashpoint was close to the tinder. Often, technicians followed the military toys into the Middle East, to Africa, India, Indonesia. Often, and perhaps more often, businessmen followed military aid, eager to find markets for the manufactured goods and for the agricultural products of their nation. Always the big powers were jockeying in this way for economic and political advantage. The Soviet Union had won military naval bases in Egypt and in Algeria, now was a Mediterranean power just in this way. Other countries were seeking the same kind of geopolitical military advantage. The world, in other words, though on the surface in the headlines, though we seem to be moving towards arrangements, below the headlines, in the unseen world where the political battles are now being fought out, the world was still at each other's neck. There was still a bitter, angry, unrelenting, remorseless struggle for geopolitical advantage. And the big powers had put themselves more and more into the sway, under the control of those whose population, those whose political leaders they sought to win over, those from whom they wanted concessions. When Anwar Sadat, angered by the unwillingness of the Soviet to send him the arms which he had specifically requested, ordered the Soviet troops out of Egypt, the Russians really had, for the moment, no alternative but to comply. Small powers were able to play off one big power against another to see from which they could get the maximum economic or political or military advantage. And just as Egypt could not be controlled by the Soviet, so it was clear that Cuba and Vietnam could not be completely controlled by Washington. When he dug in his heels about the terms which had been negotiated in Paris, it's clear that the United States was forced to take some kind of serious notice. At the same time that we recognize the increasing danger, the heightened military levels, the heightened concerns in this other world, however, we must recognize that there were certain major advantages that accrued to the world by virtue of the fact that the big powers were no longer trying to face one another down. The policy of Lebensraum, the policy of German expansion, which has been the source of the major wars of our world for the last century, since the war in Europe of 1870, was for the nonce laid to rest. During 1972, Prime Minister Willy Brandt fought out an election in West Germany on his Ostpolitik, his policy of opening windows to East Germany, to Poland, to Russia. The world, particularly the West, West Germany and the United States, seemed willing now to accept the new post-World War II reality of two Germanies. The insistence that the reunification of Germany must be a priority policy of the West no longer is stated openly by either the West German or the United States government. Both Germanies have accepted as their eastern border the Oder-Neisse line with Poland, over which much of the First and Second World Wars were fought. There are new trade relationships between Russia and West Germany. And this new détente in Central Europe has made it possible for the NATO powers and the Warsaw Pact powers to begin a whole series of new economic relationships, which at Belgrade this last month began to look forward to a new series of military relationships aiming at the reduction of field forces on the European continent. Europe itself was no longer quite the tinderbox it has been for the last 20 years. The tinderbox was to the south, in the Middle East, in Black Africa, in the Indian subcontinent, in Latin and South America, and of course in Indochina. It's here, where there's three quarters of the world's population and one half of the world's landmass and most of the world's poverty, where one in two is a total illiterate, where there must be unreasonable political combinations and ambitions and fears and movements because there is so much bitterness and so much frustration and so much deprivation. It is here. The tragedies, the wars, the bloodletting of the next decade or so must inevitably take place. In some part of this southern world, this other world, there was a desperate attempt by the moderate groups, the middle class, those in power to maintain security, to their clamp on the 90% in their countries who are poor and starving and illiterate, by imposing some kind of military dictatorship. Countries which try to move from military dictatorship to some kind of democracy, like Argentina, were finding it very difficult to do. Because even in such a country, an industrial country as Argentina, lacks the large middle class, which allows moderation, democracy to evolve. And underneath it all, there was the roiling of bright young men and women captivated because of their frustrations by all kinds of extreme revolutionary ideologies, eager to overthrow those in power, to impose, as in Chile, a new form of economics, land distribution, power on the country. But even when they succeed in their revolutions, they really can achieve very little, except perhaps to sweep away the feudalism of the last century or so, because none of these countries has the industrial infrastructure, none of them has the intellectual capacity, the trained manpower, to allow them significantly to move towards an industrial or their existence as an industrial or a post-industrial state. The tragedy which we saw unfold in Uganda during 1972, I'm afraid, will be repeated in one form or another all over this world and for many years to come. First, there is liberation from colonial rule. Black power comes into its own. There is great hope. But those who are now in power must provide food, clothing, shelter, upward mobility for the nation. And that's very difficult to do. A nation which is still riven by tribal divisions, which doesn't begin to know how to live in an urbanized society, where there are very few factories and fewer technicians who could manage them. And so there sets in a cycle of political turmoil. Outsiders like Gaddafi of Libya begin to meddle in. And soon it's the country is forced to throw out neutralist countries like Israel who are there in order to provide needed know-how. Israel is thrown out. There's economic deprivation. Let's nationalize what industry there is. The English interests are removed. But there's still economic trouble. Let's then take our revenge on those who are above us, the little middle class we have. And most of that middle class is of another stock, in this case Asian, Indian, the grandsons and granddaughters of the coolies who were brought over by the English in the last half of the 19th century in order to build the railroads from the coast into the highlands. And suddenly, 45,000 Indians are ordered out of their native land. And the results? Their shops are empty. There's looting. There's a temporary advantage of the expropriated property. But who will manage the distribution of food? Who will provide nursing and medical care? Who will be the school teachers for the school children? The entire small middle class of this country has been uprooted. The problems are simply compounded. And what's the response of the world to these kinds of problems? Most of those who were driven out of Uganda carried British passports, which they'd received before the emancipation. But England has been in the throes of unemployment and of a rise in native English racism. 3 years ago, England passed a rule that though many of the Asians from Africa carried British passports, only 3,000 would be admitted in any 1 year. Well, many of these had to be admitted, but England looked around for other countries in the world. Well, India was willing to take 1,000, and this great country of ours, another 1,000. Canada was willing to take 5,000. And what of those among the 45,000 who were stateless, who had no claim on English concern? They were stateless. And no one was paying very much attention. One English diplomat was quoted as saying, "Of course our hearts bleed for them as much as the hearts of the rest of the world." The Asians of Uganda and of Eastern Africa remind me of the Jews of Europe. And one could preach quite a Zionist sermon on the importance of land, of sovereignty, of having some kind of control over the destiny of one's own life. But once the Asians have been removed from Uganda, the problems haven't been solved. Already, Amin has begun to move against another tribe, not his, the Baranga, who are somewhat more educated, who have a few people who have made it into the middle class, because they too have a little more than the ordinary. And where does it end? It ends, I'm afraid, in a series of racial conflicts, tribal conflicts, basic, unreasonable conflicts between peoples who simply occupy adjacent areas or the same territory. And that these conflicts, I'm afraid, are going to be the hallmark of this decade. We tend to think of the struggle between the Roman Catholics and the Protestants in Northern Ireland as a sectarian struggle. It's that, of course, but it's something more. There is the immemorial poverty, overpopulation for the means of production and distribution, food supply and the like. And more than that, there's a primordial racial tribal hate between these people. I remember sometime during this year reading the report of a rather moderate Roman Catholic from Belfast, in which he spoke of having been taught from childhood to recognize an Irish Protestant at 20 feet. Remember how people used to say, "I can recognize a Jew anywhere"? That's what we have here. This recognition of primitive divisions. Protestant, Catholic, Muslim, Jew, tribesmen in Africa. And these kind of primal recognitions and divisions are going to become points of exacerbation in societies which cannot begin to supply the revolution of rising expectations, which cannot begin to satisfy the needs of their own people, who occupy a world where some countries, some people, we have so much. And where their papers and their travel and their television and their radio make very clear to them how little they really enjoy. There's no country in the world today in which you can't travel from your small kraal or farm to some major city in a matter of a day or two and not see that you live in the 10th century and that there is a 20th century and that you're not in it and not getting the advantage of it. And the problems of the other world, the third world, the undernourished world, the world of poverty, will not simply be solved by a series of political revolutions. These may be necessary, but they're going to only be solved when industry, commerce, education, medicine, recreation, all the advantages of civilization are somehow woven into the fabric of the way of life of the people in those countries. And that's going to take decades and perhaps generations. We face a world then which is going to know turmoil. We face a world in which the great powers are going to fish in these troubled waters for the hearts and the minds and the political allegiance of these peoples and of the various parties and groups and races which make them up. It's going to be an ugly struggle, I'm afraid. And perhaps it's just as well that at this point in time, America is being led by a group of men who have abandoned principle of foreign political judgment, the Protestant high-mindedness of John Foster Dulles, and even the sense of mission of Presidents Kennedy and Johnson, who were convinced that somehow by sending economic aid and the Peace Corps and some teachers into these countries, we could bring about a peaceful and reasonable and democratic evolution of these countries from their primitivism into the 20th century. Mr. Kissinger stands for Machiavelli and Metternich, for a policy of cold-blooded, calculated realism in international affairs. Diplomacy is the art of gaining at the least cost, the political, international, the economic, and military ends of your country. And peace is a temporary stasis between the competing greeds of many powers, including your own. There's no more talk in Washington now about setting an example from the world, bringing democracy to the world, setting up America as an example of moral rectitude among states. The question now is, at what cost can it be achieved? Does it tend towards the advantage of our own nation? What's in it for America. And before we condemn and dismiss out of hand this kind of cold-blooded, calculated realpolitik, let me remind you that the high-mindedness of Mr. Dulles led to the attempt to quarantine China, and that the mission of Presidents Kennedy and Johnson led to the tragedy of Vietnam. In the world as it is, it's not easy to make judgments. Greece is a military dictatorship. There are many in Greece who want more freedom, democracy. Yet the United States is in the position where she needs to have bases someplace in the Eastern Mediterranean for our fleet, particularly now that the Soviet Union has bases in the Southern Mediterranean and Eastern Mediterranean for her fleet. If we give up the bases in Greece, how do we protect our interests in the Middle East? It would be nice to deal only with countries whose policies, whose leaders agree with us. But in a world which is governed by realpolitik, where white papers exist only to explain away the black deeds of government, in such a world, perhaps there's some virtue in not picturing ourselves as the self-righteous, the goody-goods, the moral examples, and recognizing that we have power and we must use power. And however corrosive power may be, it, in the end, it is all that protects some of the freedoms and advantages which we hold dear. The world has no time for the posturing of saints. What is the real world? France claimed in the 1950s a special relationship, sympathie, between the Fourth Republic and the State of Israel. But when Algeria was behind France and there was no need to have someone who stood with France against the Arab ambitions, when France had recovered sufficiently from the Second World War so that her merchants wanted the natural markets available to her in North Africa and the Middle East, De Gaulle was quite prompt in casting aside this special sympathie, this special relationship, in favor of francs and markets, and the sale of jets to Libya. In Germany, which has every reason in the world to feel guilt, kind of special relationship with Israel. Germany was all too glad to be relieved by a kind of gentle terrorist pressure, the capture of a single plane, of three murderers from Munich who languished in her jail. The existence of these terrorists in her jail made it very difficult for good German merchants in Cairo and Baghdad and Damascus when they went to bankers there and to industrialists there in order to peddle their wares. Far better if these people were out. And when the pressure was put on Germany, she was quite willing, eager in fact, to be rid of this embarrassment. Countries of the world are greedy and they are grasping each in their own way for individual advantage. Like it or not, I'm afraid that the United States is going to have to take some positions in the world which those of us who care for morality, pure, may not like. It's a cold world out there. Sometimes our policies seem not only cold and calculating, but cruel. And yet before we condemn as murderous, as bestial, the like, the president's mining of Haiphong and Hanoi. Before we condemn as murderous and bestial, and they were murderous and bestial, the bombings of the North of the last 2 weeks, let's ask some basic questions. Who was it in May and April this year who tried to gain as much territory as possible in South Vietnam before the standfast ceasefire that was contemplated in the negotiations? What is the drive for peace in the United States? Is it quite as moral as it sounds? Yes, we have domestic problems. Yes, to kill any one person, take a life, is to murder. But I wonder if the urgency for peace is not simply a recognition that we couldn't accomplish our military ends cheaply, the cost is too high, and now regardless of the consequences to those in Vietnam, we'll get out now, immediately, without concern. Now, as one who has been opposed to the war in Vietnam for the last 10 years, I say that it's important to recognize the implicit immorality that's at the base of much of the urgency for unilateral withdrawal. Over 10 years, certainly, we have established certain kinds of responsibilities to allies, to those who died for us. 50 Vietnamese died for every one American. I don't know what the president intended to gain by unleashing our B-52s and our entire air fleet against North Vietnam over the last 2 weeks. I can't believe that whatever he thought he could gain was worth the cost. But he's dealing with determined men who have proven quite capable of murder and of violence. And if you remember, Wei and Quang Tri were quite capable of the destruction of the population of entire towns. He's dealing in the cold world, dealing in a cold and calculating way with that world. In October, Mr. Kissinger told us that peace was at hand. There was only a matter of one more meeting of 3 or 4 days before the final issues were resolved. The negotiations, as they had appeared to that time, seemed to have included, we've never been brought into the details of the issue, a standfast ceasefire, the removal of American troops from Vietnam within 60 days, concurrent release of all American prisoners of war held by North Vietnam. A proviso was added sometime after October, which agreed that the ceasefire would hold for Cambodia and Laos as well as for the two Vietnams. There would be withdrawal of both North Vietnamese and American troops from Cambodia and from Laos. There would be a provisional government of the Viet Cong and of Saigon and of some neutral forces to supervise an election to a national assembly. And the demilitarized zone as it now exists would have some status in force. What is not clear is what happened between October and December, what obstacles Mr. Chu threw in the way of Washington, what changes a victorious president, reelected by an overwhelming mandate, decided to make in the terms he would demand, what changes North Vietnam determined to make the because she saw a chance to gain advantage because there was some conflict between Saigon and Washington. What is clear is that all of the immorality does not rest with our own president, with these United States. There have always been two sides to this war. And one out from the war has always been a willingness by the North Vietnamese to stop fighting, quite as much as what should have been the unwillingness of the United States ever to begin fighting. The danger we seem now to find, much to our moral surprise, that the United States free world was far more exercised by its defense by President Nixon, and I put that in quotation marks, than was the Soviet or the Chinese world. Peking and Moscow were remarkably low-keyed in their response to the bombings the last 2 weeks compared to Sweden, some of the newspapers of the United States or of Europe. Danger seems to be not so much that the other side misreads our actions because they know how to deal in a cold and calculated way. That's their world. But that we will destroy any opportunity we have to develop a cohesive nation to deal with the critical immediate problems which face us. Most Americans are unwilling to face the consequences of living in the kind of world in which we live. We want our world to be just like our suburbs, nice, quiet, warm places where committees meet to arrange agreeably and amicably all existing problems. But the world isn't like our suburbs. And I remind you that there is a great deal of tension between our suburbs and our cities, our privileged and our underprivileged. The world is what it is, for better or for worse. Greedy, grasping, self-interested, riddled by hate, riddled by prejudice, driven by ambition. And somehow, like it or not, the Kissingers of our world read the realities of politics in many ways better than we do. The world will simply not become peace-loving and just concerned with justice because some of us dream that this is its nature. A hard truth. And I'm afraid that somehow we're going to, all of us, have to come to an understanding of what the world is really like if we're going to begin to develop the kind of cohesion which could move this country forward domestically. Because for the next 10 years or 20 years, the world is going to be predictably turbulent. There will be all kinds of international tragedies, dangers. And the United States, in order to protect itself, is very often going to have to take positions which do not sit well with a very moralistic, middle-aged, middle American, or with the young people of Consciousness 3. And yet somehow, between the people and the executive who are charged with these international responsibilities, there must be some kind of cooperation. Because God knows, when you look at the problems, the internal, the domestic problems of this nation, the need for racial justice, the need for economic justice, the need to staunch an inflation which last year cost the average person 10 cents more on every dollar that they spent for food. The need to staunch an inflation which is forcing more and more people below the poverty line. The need to deal with the problems of violence in our communities, the problems of urban blight, the problems of environment and pollution. We need some kind of unity of purpose. And we cannot always turn those who are responsible internationally into devils in our symbolic thinking, because they must sometimes take issues, take positions which we would not take in our home communities, with our family, and with our friends. The world is simply not made up of a family of nations. It's made up of bitter, competing bodies. And the structure of international relationships is still very primitive, very crude, very tenuous. The United Nations is nothing more than a debating society, a chance to make one's specific greed, if one has enough votes, seem moral. Look at the long history of United Nations resolutions vis-a-vis Israel. Look at the inability of the United Nations during 1972, after the skyjackings and after Munich, to come to any single statement condemning terrorism. All they could do, the consort of nations, was to agree that they ought to meet sometime in the future to discuss whether they ought to sometime in the future come to some resolution dealing with terrorism. That's your body of nations, your family of nations, a squabbling family, an angry family, a family ridden by individual ambitions. Would that it were otherwise. For Israel, as for the rest of the world, it was a year of tensions and no peace. Israel lost some contacts with Black Africa, largely because oil money is being thrown into these countries, badly needed dollars, and the price of receiving those dollars is the removal of Israeli aid personnel. Israel is beginning to show some of the signs of the pressures of 25 years of defense. We saw, all of you, this last month, the existence of a spy ring in Israel, including a few extreme leftists from the Matzpen, who had convinced themselves that only by the destruction of the state that some kind of true democratic modern community emerge. We saw Israel struggle to pay the price of defense. We saw the squabble in Israel between those who advocate certain kinds of territorial solutions and others who advocate other kinds of territorial solutions. It was not peace and not war. And that was the condition of most of our world. Good year, we're alive. A good year, I don't know. There was something on the order of 10 million more illiterates in our world at the end of 1972 than at the beginning. The gap between the have and the have-not nations increased during 1972, and the level of armaments in the have-not nations increased during 1972. At the top, arrangements. Below, confusion. How shall we read the year? Well, if this year has any message, it seems to me it is this. There is a world. It's a world filled with 3 billion people. It's a world where no one will remain for long out of things, deprived and denied. The world of rising expectations, and therefore a turbulent world. It's a world where the balance of terror at the top has made it clear that the big nations cannot lock horns with each other directly. It's a world where the smaller nations are just beginning to lock horns. and just begin to have the firepower to do so in very bloody ways. It's a cruel world. And that's the first truth of 1972. It's not a world without hope. There is a great deal of wealth and moral wisdom. There are a lot of concerned people in our world, in this country and in every other. There's a desire for peace because intelligent people know that there's no gain in bloodletting. But there's no gain in moral posturing either. And the challenge for the next year and for the next decade, I think, will be whether or not we can hard-headedly move towards the construction of those relationships between nations and between peoples and within nations, which will allow some degree of security and peace for all and allow us to spend our time and our energies destroying poverty and making war on ignorance and fighting the good fight with the right enemy. I wish I could speak to you more hopefully. But it was simply the kind of year in which the Nobel Committee could find no one worthy of a Peace Prize. And what we need are millions of people worthy of that prize. Amen.